At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's what I need you to do for me. Get out your handy-dandy Federal Reserve thesaurus and look for synonyms for the phrase considerable time. And then stay tuned and we'll tell you what the Fed itself came up with. How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 17th of December today. Good to have you with us. You know how people, all right, business reporters and analysts mostly, fine, but we're still people. We like to parse the language the Federal Reserve uses to try to figure out what they actually mean, because central bankers can be opaque. Today, though, today might have taken the cake. Regular listeners to this program will know that the big if about the Fed lately has been whether they will keep interest rates lower for a considerable time. That's the phrase they've been using in those statements they make after meetings. Today, they changed it. Kind of. Here's Fed Chair Janet Yellen from her press conference this afternoon.
Today's statement, which indicates that the committee judges that it can be patient in beginning to normalize the stance of monetary policy, does not signify any change in the committee's policy intentions as set forth in its recent statements.
You missed it if you blinked. I know it's dense, but she said patience. Now the Fed can be patient with rates.
Given that the committee is not signaling a change in policy, why did we update our guidance?
I don't know. Actually, that's not true. We do know. Basically, they decided they didn't want to talk about quantitative easing anymore, their bond buying program, the end of which is what considerable time had been referring to, as in the Fed will keep rates low for a considerable time after quantitative easing ends. It has now ended. They are moving on. So I guess should we. Here is the kicker, though, quickly, for those looking for when exactly the Federal Reserve might think about raising rates. Here you go.
In particular, the committee considers it unlikely to begin the normalization process for at least the next couple of meetings.
Quick check of the Fed calendar, which you can look up yourself online. Meetings in January and March next year. And yes, somebody did ask her, by the way, if a couple meant two. It does. That makes the April Fed meeting. It's April 30th and May 1st, technically, what you might call loaded. All right, moving on. Full disclosure on this next story. I said yesterday on Twitter that Sony was going to pull its big Christmas movie, The Interview, the one about killing North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I was just guessing. Honestly, I was, based on the threats from the Sony hackers about September 11th-style violence at theaters that do wind up showing the film. I did not, however, think things would happen quite this fast. Today, Sony said it is not going to, quote, move forward with The Interview. The film was never pegged to be a blockbuster, but now, what does Sony do dollar-wise? What's it going to mean for them? Nova Sappho has that story.
Sony is a big film studio, and The Interview, with its modest $45 million budget, is relatively small fare for the company.
It's not your typical X-Men type of blockbuster, where there are endless commercial tie-ins.
That's Jennifer Holt, a professor of film and media studies at the University of California. Holt says Sony will take a hit, but it was far riskier for the entire movie business if it's screened during Christmas.
The Christmas season is a huge time for the movie business, and it's a time where they bring out all of their marquee films. So this is a very big revenue period.
Eric Wald, an analyst with B. Riley & Company, says movies are expected to bring in $2.5 billion in revenues during the last 3 months of the year. The Interview represented just 2% of that. Holt says for theater chains, it'll be easy to pivot to the many other films competing for audiences on Christmas.
You get around the holidays, and a lot of consumers just want to see a movie. you clearly can fill it up with a bunch of other movies that are coming out this holiday.
Movies like The Hobbit or Into the Woods. But Jason Squire, a film professor at USC and editor of the Movie Business book, says the implications go far beyond this one film.
This is really going to have a negative impact on what is an artistic business venture.
Squire says because of the attack on Sony, all movie studios are likely to become more cautious about the content of their films in the future. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
It took them a while, but traders on Wall Street eventually decided today that they were okay with the Fed's word choice. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The big energy headline of the day comes not from Saudi Arabia or the New York Mercantile Exchange or the Bakken oil field up in North Dakota. It comes instead from Albany, New York, and Governor Andrew Cuomo, who said today he is going to ban fracking in that state after more than 6 years of political infighting and environmental wrangling. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been covering fracking for us all over the country. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
What do we know about how this happened? I'm sure the conversations in Albany were intense.
Well, as always, these political conversations are about costs and benefits. In this conversation in the country, we have one part of the country who are talking about the benefits and how great they are, and we have another separate side of the country that's worrying about the costs. And mm-hmm. and they don't tend to mix, as you know. They tend to be in red places and blue places. And that happened in New York, too. You had people in the countryside who were sitting on top shale who were looking at the benefits, and they were arguing that we should move this forward. And you have people in the city who are worrying about the costs and the risks, and they're downstream in the watershed. And so the governor here has to figure out how to split this baby. And in the end, he didn't. He decided that we're going to ban it statewide. And that came after 6 years of political wrangling and decision-making. Interestingly, his health commissioner came out and talked about risks and potential risks, but he also came out and said, you know, would I allow my children to live near a drilling site? No, I wouldn't.
Lots of towns and municipalities have spoken out against fracking. New York mm-hmm. is the first state to do so. What's going to happen now, do you think?
The people I talked to quickly said it is very significant. As you mentioned, there are localized bans in parts of Texas and Pennsylvania mm-hmm. and Colorado. States of Illinois and Maryland have said yes, but we're going to put certain rules and restrictions on it. So where does the New York ban fit into this? I put the question to Michael Levy. He's an environment and energy scholar at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he said, for future debates, this New York news now puts a new question out there.
It's very different to ask someone, how do you feel about the risks, than it is to ask them, the New York State Health Commissioner said that he wouldn't allow his children to live near these sites. Would you?
Now, Kai, I spoke to a couple other folks about this. Mm-hmm. This could provoke additional conversations about statewide bans, and the industry obviously fears that. And it could influence how other countries look at this. You know, other places have shale, Argentina, Poland, mm-hmm. England, China, and they're all watching how it goes here in the States, Kai.
What have we learned? I mean, we've been fracking now for a long time. There's a lot of it. There's been a lot yep. of research. What do we know?
We know a lot more about the benefits, and they're very clear. We have a lot of natural gas that we've been able to find in the States. We have a lot of it, and so we have the cheapest natural gas and electricity in the world. That's a great economic benefit compared to other countries. It gives our factories a big boost right now. Mm-hmm. It gives our petrochemical industry a big boost because they're making products that come from natural gas. And of course, fracking brings us a lot of oil now, and we're seeing the global hangover of so much oil produced right. in the United States. On the cost side, those questions take longer to answer. There are questions about, are the wells constructed the right way? And that takes time to find out. There could be chemicals or hydrocarbons that spill out, but that takes time to measure. There's a correlation in some places between medical symptoms and oil wells. Hmm. There are small earthquakes. And so that comes a lot slower. And that's the challenge here. The benefits sometimes are much clearer to understand, and the costs take longer to understand. And that's yeah. where we are.
Marketplace's Scott Tong on the ban from New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo today on fracking. We are, I should say, doing a special program tomorrow on oil, how it's a part of all of our lives, whether we know it or not. And for that, actually, we need your help. Tell us, send us your stories. You can do that at marketplace.org. Scott, thanks a bunch.
Okay, you're welcome. We'll be right back.
The two-day tally for the decline of the ruble is 15%. That's just a bit more than 8% yesterday, another 6.5% today, which is, I suppose you could say, in one light, progress. The Russian currency has been the global economic story this week, unless you're reading and watching Russia's state-run media. They have a different take, that Vladimir Putin is standing up to the West and that lower imports because of a cheaper currency will give Russian businesses a chance to grow. Russian journalists have long complained about a lack of basic press freedoms under Putin, so a group of them has moved to the Baltic state of Latvia to set up their own independent online service to give Russians objective news. Their departure was triggered by the firing of a well-known and independent editor. Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes up the story from there.
Galina Timchenko was the editor-in-chief of the Russian online news service Lenta until earlier this year. After carrying some stories that were critical of Russia's involvement in Ukraine, Timchenko was fired.
The fact is that I was replaced by a PR manager, and he was very close to administration of President Putin.
Nursing a sore throat and speaking from her self-imposed exile in Latvia, Timchenko says she believes the oligarch owner of the Lenta website was lent on by the Russian government.
It's a very usual situation to put pressure on the owner of media.
That's putting it mildly. Russia is gaining a grisly international reputation. It's been ranked 148th out of 173 nations for press freedom. Melody Patry is with the Index on Censorship Campaign Group.
Journalists, media workers and news providers receive threats, intimidation, sometimes even physical abuse. And it is all the more concerning when editors-in-chief are being fired for political reasons.
After the firing of Galina Timchenko, all 70 journalists on her staff quit in protest, and 20 of them followed her to Latvia. In a converted warehouse in the capital, Riga, they're now producing a new independent Russian-language news service, Medusa. The service is published not only on a website, but also on an app to prevent the Kremlin from barring it.
It's more difficult to block, and as far as I know, there is no examples of blocking apps in Russia still.
The site's in its infancy, attracting around 81,000 users a day, compared with Lenta's 3 million. Medusa will make its money from subscriptions, ads and app sales, but unusually for an organization committed to openness and transparency, it won't reveal the cost of setting up in Latvia or the source of the money. That's ringing alarm bells.
I find this problematic, the fact that this project would not actually reveal where the funding is coming from.
Independent Russian commentator Vladimir Strukov of Leeds University in England says this coyness about financing could be self-defeating.
It just gives a kind of a sense of there's something happening there, and it kind of, I think it breeds conspiracy theories among bloggers and other media users in Russia.
Back in the Latvian capital, Galina Timchenko says she won't reveal the names of her financial backers in order to protect them from harassment by the Kremlin.
I want to decrease political risks for them.
She's given Medusa 3 years to break even, but agrees she has her work cut out. In spite of Russia's growing economic problems, Putin remains wildly popular. His message is apparently still more appealing to the Russian public than what the independent media has to say. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is our Beverly Hills Entertainment Relations Showroom.
The CEO of Gibson Guitars, and yes, we do get him to play something for us. But first, let's do the numbers. What does a guy have to do to get the really happy music around here? Come on. Dow's up 288 points, 1 2/3%, closes at 17,356, and nothing? Anyway, the NASDAQ up 2 10%, 96 points, finished at 4,644. The S&P 500 regained 2%, 40 points, closed at 2,012. Maybe I just needed the happy numbers. How about that? Word from the Fed that it will be patient in raising interest rates put investors in a buying mood. Morgan Stanley took home more than 3% today. Citigroup climbed 2.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited itself 2.25% today. The prospects of doing more business with Cuba gave all sorts of companies a boost. Carnival Cruise Lines floated up more than 3% on the news of the detente, I guess you might say. Coke fizzed up nearly 3%. Walmart bagged a 1.5% gain. Nike ran up 1.33% today. Major European exchanges were mixed. Bond prices back here fell. The yield on the Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury note, rose to 2.13%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years. And believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rosdahl, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board issues its Index of Leading Economic Indicators for November. The United Nations observes International Migrants Day. And it's the anniversary of a Christmas tradition, Sugar Plum Fairies. Tchaikovsky's ballet, The Nutcracker, premiered in St. Petersburg on December 18, 1892. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Americans buy a whole lot of Christmas trees, more than 33 million of them last year alone, which makes it a billion-dollar industry in this country. That is a lot of evergreen, if you will. Perhaps nowhere are Christmas tree sales more visible than on the streets of New York City, literally on the streets and sidewalks. But it's not all good Yuletide feelings in that business. Ike Sriskandaraja takes us inside the world of New York City's Christmas tree vendors.
Supriya and Vijay Lucknady walk through a narrow evergreen forest on a sidewalk in Brooklyn Heights. They stop in front of a 7-foot Fraser fir.
It's pretty full, you know, so even if you don't have that many ornaments on there, it still looks like a really healthy tree.
We just had our first kid, so it's a tree with an occasion now.
The Lucknadys are purchasing their family's tree from another family tree.
My family started in 1988 when I was about 13 months old.
Ellie Bishop, with baby in tow, helps run the stand with her mom and brother. These three generations of tree sellers manage a stable in Vermont the rest of the year. But Ellie explains that's not necessarily where the trees come from.
Well, it kind of works like this. A bunch of tree sellers all throughout the city get together. We buy from big tree farms in different parts of the country. These ones came from North Carolina, sometimes all the way from Oregon. Just depends where they're ordered from, where we get the best deal.
Ellie's supplier buys evergreens from wherever they grow the fastest. And the vendors, they come from wherever work during the winter is slow.
Selling trees really helps people get through January, February until they can get back to work in March.
Last year, Ellie's family sold about 300 trees, mostly priced between $55 and $140. It's not easy work, on the street, in freezing temperatures, 24/7 for most of December. Still, it's enough to lure seasonal workers from near and far.
I like my tree, all of them, you know? I likewise they are fluffy and big.
Melanie Westerloop runs a stand in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan. High-end trees here go for $400. Last year, she sold to Robert De Niro. It's the adventure, as well as the money, that lures hundreds of French Canadians to the city.
Our company, it's about 300 stands in the city, because we have 2 or 3 people by stand.
The company, called Forever Evergreen, is incorporated in Florida and supplies to all of the stands I came across, and owns hundreds of its own. The company is pretty secretive. They run a cash business that's largely unregulated and staffed by a migrant workforce.
My title is, a Christmas tree seller from the north.
Simon Durant also sells trees in Manhattan. I asked him why a Florida-based company buying trees from North Carolina wants French Canadians to sell Christmas trees in New York City.
They like a Quebecois with an accent on the street selling the trees and looking like a North Viking. That's what they like. And it works. It works. People like to buy trees from us.
Simon, who's a carpenter in Quebec the rest of the year, doesn't mind living out of his van for a month. He estimates he makes $17 an hour for the season. But there are other perks for these French-speaking, pine-scented gentlemen.
Girls here are very attractive. I mean, they're very beautiful. You know, they don't see often people like us cutting trees with a saw, and sometimes it looks like it impresses some people.
In New York, I'm Ike Sriskandaraja for Marketplace.
The Gibson Guitar Corporation isn't just guitars anymore. They own Baldwin pianos, they make high-end recording equipment, and of course, their signature Les Paul models as well. They are also getting into the live entertainment business, taking over the iconic Tower Records building here in Los Angeles, right on the Sunset Strip. It's just part of a bunch of changes that Gibson is making to be known now for more than just guitars.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, the owner and CEO of Gibson, as it's now known, Henry Juskowitz. We did a little walking and talking and guitar playing at the Gibson showroom out in Beverly Hills.
This is our Beverly Hills Entertainment Relations showroom. We've been here a long, long time. It's a really great place for us because L.A. is the center of entertainment.
All right, I want to walk around for a little bit and just get you to tell me about some of the stuff that's on the walls, right? And as we do that, I want you to tell me what it is about a Gibson that's special, right? Because you can get a Fender and you can get a zillion other kinds of guitars. Why a Gibson? Give me the pitch.
Well, this is our 2015 model. You could see, I will describe it for the radio audience. But you're going to do what's called a sight line, which is look down the fret. And so what you want to do is be relatively flat. And you can see this is pretty incredibly great. And if you ever did that on less expensive guitars, you'd notice clearly the difference. And then you would play it without an amplifier because you're really hearing the guitar. See, I usually play a pick.
So you want to hear it without the electronics, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Because that's the guitar. Once you start putting it through other stuff, as Les said, you know, you can't get better than the source.
All right, so here's the fundamental question, right?
Yeah.
Why, if what you want to hear is the guitar and not the amplification, why are electric guitars important, if that makes any sense?
Because music needs to be loud. I mean, I would not be able to play in front of you this loud, right? So,
I mean, you grew up playing guitar, right?
Yes.
Yeah? Were you in, like in a band and stuff?
Yes. My first band had an accordion because we played a lot of weddings.
Wow.
So that's a scoop, by the way. I don't usually share that.
So if I wanted to go out and buy a brand new Les Paul 2015 100th anniversary model, how much is it going to cost me, this thing in your hands?
Boy, it's approximately $2,000. It
depends. That's not cheap.
Because we have Les Pauls in several different... This is a standard, I think. But we have about 10 models. It's on our website. You can see all the prices and the differences between the various price points.
Who are your customers? Who buys most of your stuff?
Because it's an expensive... The Gibson brand is expensive.
It's the discretionary income purchase,
so
right?
Typically, it's somebody that is, you know, 35 or older and... Generally, you know, their kids are already approaching college or in college, so they have more time and more income to devote to what they really love to do.
So talk to me for a minute about the music business today, right? Because you're in, it's not quite vertical, but you've got a big chunk of live performance music businesses and tape music businesses.
Well, what we want to do is
right?
is to be in the music business. You know, people used to be in the musical instrument business, or they used to be in the recording business, or they used to be in the studio gear business. And music is music, and people have to work together to make sure that the customer in the end has an exceptional experience. I tried working with people to do that, and that didn't work out, so I guess you have to buy them and... So we're in recording gear, we're in studio monitors, pianos, but it's in the music. We are in the music business, not just one segment.
What keeps you up at night, business-wise?
Wow. so many things, I wonder how I can sleep. You know, we just got into the headphone business. You know, we have, you know, Apple and Beats kind of
to
deal with, Bose. Yeah, you know, business is about competition. There are a lot of people who would love to knock us off. The bigger you are, the better the people you're competing with. And, you know, that could keep you up at night. Well, I mean, Apple's got a little money, I heard.
Yeah, a little bit. And Dr. Dre, do me a favor and play something to take us out on. Henry, thanks very much for your time.
All right. So.
That was Henry Jeskowitz, the CEO of Gibson, playing a little something for us on the way out there. All the other interviews from our series, Conversations from the Corner Office, are online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a small geopolitical development you might have heard about. Cuba and the United States taking steps to normalize their long troubled relationship in both politics and economics. Sadly, not everybody heard about it, specifically those who bought shares of the Cuba Beverage Company today, ticker symbol CUBV. It's an energy drink firm out of San Diego, California, no relation to Cuba, the country at all. Shares were up 78.9% today, to 3.5 cents a piece. It's not a big energy drink company, I guess. Same kind of thing happened when Twitter went public, if I recall. Caveat emptor, y'all. Caveat emptor. All right, we are done. That is it. Today, the Dow up 1 2/3%, 288 points after the Fed meeting. Patience, everybody, patience. The NASDAQ picked up 2 1/10%, 96 points. The S&P 500 regained 2%, or 40 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe. Engineer of the broadcast for us, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.